Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. In 1965, the BBC introduced the television programme Tomorrow's World, which ran for almost 40 years. It showcased future innovations and developments in science, technology, and healthcare, often uncovering inventions which became integral to modern life, from virtual reality and AI to space exploration. At the investment level, the commercialization of some of today's inventions will bring potent returns and shape businesses of the future, yet their identification, incubation, financing, and shepherding require vision, skill, and patience. And here today to discuss his approach and their new fund's access to such opportunities is a repeat guest, partner and high respected portfolio manager of Lansdowne Partners, Peter Davis. Peter, welcome to this curated edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Pleasure.
The great point about you having appeared as a guest before in July 2021, nearly 4 years ago, is that for listeners in the US and other countries less familiar with your investment career in Lansdowne, but now important parts of our audience, they can listen to that episode. The only difference being that that was before we introduced video to all of our recordings, and it was you who quipped. You had the perfect face for radio.
Before someone else did.
So for those who aren't familiar, Lansdowne Partners is a highly regarded UK-based investment management firm, which has morphed from predominantly hedge fund into predominantly long only, and characterised by its thinking, forward-looking, contrarian, data-driven, and quietly analytical approach. So, you've been at the heart of the firm for a long time and achieved notable investment success. And let's start by dissecting your investment approach, because you became recognized as an investor in public markets, and over the last decade have developed a parallel appetite and success for investing in emerging private companies. Just let us understand how that came about.
I'd take it a bit further back, because I think the basic, I mean, obviously what one's looking to do in investment is find stuff that is an opportunity where one feels well equipped personally to take advantage of it, given one's expertise. Many of the things you think of when you think about the UK and other great brands or whatever are actually rarely corporate entities and often viewed as financial liabilities. And I think that insight for me kicked off with Stuart, actually, when we were doing the listed side, with football clubs. You know, I remember being in Africa and seeing Man United brands literally next to Coca-Cola brands and thinking, A, everyone in the world knows who Manchester United are and everyone has a view on it, some positive, some negative, similar to Coke. But B, the value of Coke is self-evident, whereas Manchester United at the time was listed but was viewed as a non-commercial company. So the first time we had that insight, I had that insight anyway, was football clubs, which was a listed opportunity. The other side of it, namely, these assets often require capital and attitudinal shift to be really realized properly. Clearly, in that case, Sky, BT, etc., provided the capital. We didn't have to do very much. And there's a lovely story about football clubs that I'll, or lots of lovely stories about our investments in football clubs, I can tell you. But the basic point was that subsequent upon that, you know, I was thinking about this and very clear in my mind that there were lots of other similar opportunities in the UK. The biggest one of which was universities. You know, to my mind, universities in the UK, again, the world-class brands, the IP they create broader than any company that, you know, if you take a company like Google, it's a fraction of the IP that a leading university would have. And for any number of long-term reasons, going to my point about liability, generally viewed as a tax on the system, not an economic asset. And, you know, having done a lot of work with that and helped by some friends who spent a lot more time in that, we spent a lot of time from about 2010 through 2015 talking to all the UK universities saying, okay, how can we accelerate the progress of some of these ideas into companies? Recognize pleasingly that the academic attitudes are shifting, whereby most academics did want to do that, whereas perhaps 20 years ago wouldn't have done. And created various companies, all the universities in the UK I've worked with in some form, I think. But the defining point was 2015, and this is still while we were running a hedge fund, where we were lucky enough to be part of founding a company called OSE in Oxford, which partnered up with the university, raised nearly £1 billion, has funded, you know, a couple of hundred companies inset subsequent to that, and really validated the point that there are some amazing opportunities out there. we did that within the hedge fund that we were investors. I then went to be chairperson of OSE and spent 4 years helping it establish itself within the ecosystem, and thankfully now handed over to people who, if you like, industrializing it, probably is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, making it, taking the second generation of progress for it. Anyway, that took us through to 2020. And in 2020, basically, I kind of looked through the OSE portfolio, knew all the companies. Basically, the companies that I'd known for 5 years were now getting to the point where I wanted to invest in them directly rather than just at the aggregate level. You know, I could see which ones were interesting, which ones were less interesting. And separately, felt like, obviously, we didn't really have the right from a client perspective to do that. So what we did was, at the point where we were shutting, we decided we didn't really want to do shorting for reasons we could talk about elsewhere, decided to set up a fund which we called the Ops Fund, which is kind of about 60% our money. So it gave us permission to do stuff that we hadn't done before in a way that perhaps we hadn't done before. And in the time subsequent upon that, which we can come on to talk about, we did probably two, and have been investing in unlisted since then as a separate business, separate liquidity pool, etc. And in that, I think we've probably done two things, which brings us up to where we are now. One is see a lot of the companies that have come through get to a point where they're ready to be scaled properly. And two, expanded our awareness and expertise, both within the Oxford ecosystem to areas like quantum and healthcare data that we'll talk about, but more broadly, take on other areas where we could see a similar opportunity, like defense, like biodiversity, like sport. And I think really build a differentiated network that leaves us very interestingly placed for going forward. And that's kind of how we got here. We can talk about where we're going. Sorry, that was a long answer.
Well, we don't need to talk about the shorting because you actually have, I was listening to the other day, talked about your shift away from having a short book, you know, in the first interview. But before we get into investment process, one of the criticisms of the UK's investment organizational sort of, you know, apparatus is the shortage of development capital to support and scale world-class IP. Now, you're going to play a role in that, but more generally, are there reasons for you being a little more optimistic?
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I think for me, what we're doing now, which is essentially raising a fund, which is going to be 90% client money rather than, you know, is a proper third-party fund, is one that the opportunity of the companies is that they're ready for scale-up capital. And actually, I think compelling investments are available in a way that perhaps hasn't. It was only possible because we sorted out some of the startup stuff 10, 15 years ago. But two, and this will be the proof point of the fund, it's very clear that lots of people now want to do this. They just don't quite know how to do it. And if we've got a role, which I hope we have, I think we're quite well positioned to help some of the people translate a desire to be part of this, an actually very large financial commitment, with an awareness that this is a new area for them. They want to try out different things. They want to work with people they trust. You know, often people who've known us from different investment fields want to work with us. So what's been fascinating, I'd say there are two areas that are definitely going to do this, who are new and going to be huge. One is the DC defined contribution scheme. For those who don't know, Britain, part of the problem in British capital provision is that historically people got guaranteed a pension in a defined benefit scheme and the company was exposed to the liability. Regulators effectively said that you can't take any risk with that capital because you might not pay the liability. Companies reacted to that by saying, okay, we're going to offer pensioners a pot of money that they invest, that they take the risk on, which is called defined contribution. That pot of money gradually has swapped, and now the defined contribution schemes are getting bigger and bigger, and within 2 or 3 years will cross over. Those defined contribution schemes probably should always have been doing this sort of thing, but as a result of the other big change, which is, I think the world has changed in terms of what the duty of investors is. You know, we can talk about ESG in a sec, but to me, quite rightly, investing in your community has become a bigger part of ESG, and some of the other issues probably dropped off a bit. So what you've got is the DC community definitely want to do it. And that's big life insurers, often the other sort of more specialized areas. And then the other schemes, which again have partly because of their liability structures, the local government schemes, again, I think what we've experienced from talking to them is a huge desire to play a role in this part of the ecosystem. But again, a bit of a question of how to do it. And you'll have seen last week, and these are big amounts of money. So both of those, you know, probably will end up with about 5% of their assets in this kind of stuff. And both of them are close half a trillion plus of assets. So it's really, really exciting, actually, that I think within 5 years, you could easily see 50 billion go into this money when, you know, frankly, I'd be amazed if maybe 4 billion's gone in perhaps in the last few years. What's different today is that theoretical possibility now is obvious when you talk to people, that they're now at the question of not what do they want to do, it's how do we do it, which is, I think, where today is the right time to do the fund.
When we talk about your idea sourcing, yeah, you've discussed the relationship with the university community. I know you've also invested, you know, with TechMex. We've had Brian Mandel on the Money Is podcast. That's a fascinating business. Yeah. How do companies typically get onto your dashboard? Let's talk about the sourcing.
I think we've been on a journey that's been fairly iterative. So if you take TechMet, for instance, this must be 7-8 years ago, even before we did this fund, Brian and I knew one another, and I think I was probably the first ever, and I mean, I may have about the first investor in TechMet. You know, similarly, when we Helsing the defense area, you know, it's from, you know, that for me anyway, stemmed from going for a walk with a friend of mine, debating something interesting, knowing that he was very well qualified to do it. And like so many bits of institutional investing, there's a danger you just get pigeonholed. You know, like if you've done enterprise software before, you want your clients theoretically want you to do it again. And if you look at what we've done in the listed space, one of the things that comes quite naturally to us is what area is going to be interesting in 5 years' time that perhaps wasn't interesting 5 years ago is probably the way we think about it. And so when we started 5 years ago doing this in a more dedicated fashion, we had a fairly, you know, it came, whether we executed them or not, depended on whether we met a Brian or a Torsten. But in terms of which areas we thought were going to be interesting, defense, critical minerals, sport, conservation was an area that we knew was going to be very interesting. And then within the Oxford ecosystem, trending towards things like quantum computing and healthcare data. So hopefully we've allowed it to be an iterative process where we see lots and lots of things, have a pretty clear idea of where we're going and where we might find opportunities. And then actually the precise opportunity almost gets hollowed through by saying, okay, it's someone like Brian, you want to do something, tell us what you want to do. Then we can go through a very analytic process of, is the specific plan going to work or not? But I think we've been more open to knowing where to look. And definitely today, what's so exciting is the areas we started 5-6 years ago are now, maybe through a bit of luck and a bit of judgment, by thinking like that, we're in a good place of having expertise in areas that have become more important than they were when we first started. And now that we're at the point of scaling individual companies, that's exactly where you want to be. You want to have the deep expertise in things like quantum and critical minerals during the period where that capital to scale them up is ready. And so I think we're in quite good shape on that.
And finally, on this part, should we expect any change in the fact that there's been a systematic failure to commercialize these things on a long lead time in the UK? You know, they typically get absorbed into other entities, often US-based.
So what we're going to do is we'll probably find for this fund about 10 companies. If you said what's a sweet spot for us and why, you know, actually something like a Quantinuum, for instance, or even a Helsing now, when it's raising $500 million, it doesn't really matter whether it's in the UK or US. The world is pretty efficient in that. Where systemically there's both a lot of opportunities and it's not done properly today is there's a lot of companies that we see that are trying to raise 20 million. If they raised 100 million, they'd have a real chance of competing and scaling up, but 20 million never quite gets you there. And I think that's the sweet spot that we want to pay in. And our aim for the fund is to find about 10 of those over the next 3 years, of which I could probably tell you 3 or 4 of them today, lead the investment rounds and them in the funds, but work with what we're saying to our clients is we want you to be both fund investors, but also co-investors in the areas such that actually the companies we're investing in maybe get $10, $15 million from us, but can get another $30, $40 million from the people who we're working with, which has huge benefits, I think, both for the companies. It helps our clients gradually morph into this form of investing. And frankly, from an economic perspective, brings the fee level down to a level that I think is fair for scale-up investing, which can be a bit prohibitively expensive. So I think that's the area we're going to do. To your question then about exits, I would say the biggest thing I think I knew it, but definitely learned has been in 5 years of doing this, one of the great virtues is a bit like the learnings I had as a listed investor when I came in as super analytic, well, not super analytic, confident in my analytic skill, overconfident in my analytic skills. Anyway, the critical thing for me was I got to work with people who were really good at markets, and I had no, and to this question of how I developed as an investor, finding a way of synthesizing my analytic skills with some market skills was what was critical to develop into an investor on the listed space. Same thing in the last few years, having done ventures, I've learned a ton of stuff, and we can talk about some of the things I've learned. But one of the major ones I've learned is that actually, when you put capital in at a particular stage, to me, the only thing you should worry about is what's the next stage and what's the value inflection that's going to happen because of that. Both from an upside perspective, I think that kind of conditions you to sort of price these things sensibly. And I definitely think from a risk phase, overly focusing on what might happen in 20 years' time is very, very dangerous because it's often not your equity that actually contributes to that. And so certainly when I think about how we're going to do these investments, in all cases, the clarity of what the value proposition of the immediate capital is dominant in my mind rather than the ultimate thing, reflecting also the reality, which is, you know, if you create something valuable, finding the right way to monetize it usually isn't that difficult. And we've seen this within Oxford, for instance. You know, our biggest realization was a company that we did sell, despite having a general attitude of trying to build companies. The reason we sold it was a subcomponent of a situation where two or three major companies, it was the thing that would make one of the products of three incumbents better than the other two. There was no point building a business for that. The only way to optimize value is to get those three to bid against one another for their differentiation. You know, had we just replicated all the other stuff we'd done, waste of time. So I think normally it's pretty logical how you exit these things.
So back to your filtering, because your limitations are bandwidth and capital, and you're being offered numerous ideas. And how does your team build a process that allows you to be very efficient? Because you said to me on the last interview that you, to try and manage your time better, you actually took things away every year that you do. And, you know, I know you're a highly organized person. Tell me how you've managed this process with your colleagues.
We have the same team doing listed and unlisted from a research perspective. So we'd want the same people to look at companies, including me. In the same way we do our listed investing, we want multiple people looking at the same thing rather than segmenting it, because we want different perspectives and we want a conversation. So we do all of that stuff. And many of us would see most of the companies in the thing, especially as we mature into a sort of more client-led business. There will be some dedicated resource, and that will be more the around the monitoring and development of positions rather than the selection of them. And definitely we will have our own networks, and probably my network brings in more ideas, but certainly the other people do as well. It's relatively, I don't know, actually, it's relatively easy to prioritize things, because we just chat about, you know, we're seeing lots of stuff. Something excites you, you get someone else to see it. Something excites them, they ask me about it. And we do have, and now we're moving to the scale up phase. It's much more, well, what do you think should happen to this company? Is it happening? I'll give you, we had an example the other day where one of our companies who may well feature in this fund, great investment as it stands, called me up and said, look, there's this acquisition we could do that would be amazing. The meetings follow from that. Is it a good idea? You know, it becomes very natural. So the lovely thing we've got at the moment is, because we've allowed ourselves to follow through these companies rather than try and, you know, if you're sitting there having to find the new enterprise software company at the same level as the last one you found, life becomes very complicated, because you just got to basically replicate what you did before. While what we're trying to do is more challenging from a client perspective, it's actually more logical from an analytic perspective, because you're basically following, you know, we started the platforms, we saw the companies come out of them, we're now trying to develop them. It's a fairly logical process.
And what have you learned from the successes like a Nanopore or a Raspberry Pi? And on the flip side of that, one of the ones that hasn't worked, because as we know, that's just going to, you know, feature.
Well, lots of things. I think of the ones that didn't work in this last 5-year process. I mean, normally the point, which Raspberry Pi is the counterexample of, is that people misprice the time value of options. So the beauty of Raspberry Pi, we were the first investors of Raspberry Pi in financial terms, in part, I think, because partly because we knew the ecosystem well and we had friends there who said, will you have a look at this for us? We want to know what to do. Partly because they were going through a process of gradually becoming a listed company, and our expertise across the spectrum was kind of, they kind of viewed us as someone, I think, and subsequently, I hope, because they felt like the industrial and market advice we gave them has been helpful. But what was interesting about Raspberry Pi was when we invested in, and I still think that has the capacity to be one of the biggest companies in the world. You know, I think they could genuinely dominate edge computing. And I think edge computing, as AI gets cheaper and physical objects get more intelligent, the distributed nature of compute could easily be something that they dominate, which is, I think, why the likes of Arm are investing in them. So they have massive optionality still if they deliver. But the critical thing was they were already profitable. They paid us a dividend during the period of that, which, whereas by contrast, if you look at most of the errors, it takes too long and your equity is worthless because somebody else's equity comes into, you know, that's the typical error. And what was fascinating is when we were looking at some of the due diligence that some of the clients want to do, actually, because they've been, a lot of the VC community has grown up around massive winners being the only thing that matter. The reality that Raspberry Pi had a totally different risk profile to the average venture investment because it was cash generative, never got priced. It's very hard to accommodate. And yet to me is totally intuitive. And so I think the most obvious one is time is valuable. And that in turn informs the fact that we will try really hard to value stuff based around what can our capital do and how likely is it to go wrong. I think the other one we found, the biggest mistake we made in the last few years was a company which we kind of wanted to back, but scaling out some of those other investors at a high price. And we were silly and saying that we really want to invest with these people. But that mistake is one that I've seen many times before, of more capital at a lower price is always better, which I guess is a subset of the time point.
So you've hinted it, but I'd just like to pause on Lansdowne's involvement, because you're bringing more than capital to these enterprises. How would you, if you're sitting in front of a, you know, a management team that wants capital and maybe it's got two or three people, you know, for who might be the providers, how would you essentially deliver the message of what you can do beyond capital?
I mean, most of the time it's that we get the idea. I mean, you know, or that we've known them for a long, long time anyway. So if you think about, in practice, most of the things we do over the next few years will be a function of the trust we built up over many, many years beforehand. And I probably won't be having to have that conversation very often, is what really differentiates us. I think in practice, in the past, three things hopefully have done it. One is an ability to understand where we're going, but also understand what the staging posts are to get there and help them with the analysis of, okay, if that's your ultimate dream, let's get the staging post. We want to do that, but we want to do it in a way that makes practical sense. And if you took something like founding OSE, for instance, the skill there was not, ironically, often people say, what a brilliant idea. That wasn't that a good idea. It's a really obvious idea. The problem is, if it's such an obvious idea, trying to help Oxford commercialize their IP and no one's done it, it's probably really hard to execute. And I think sometimes having that synthesis of being clear on what you're ultimately trying to do, but willing to work out the individual detail realistically to do it. I think secondly, partly because of that, I think we find it relatively easy, I think, to articulate what the appropriate and fair risk reward is for an investment. You know, I think normally people understand why we're saying something, you know, understand what risk it is. And often companies with their investors need to, they wouldn't quite describe it as a grown up in the room who's willing. And then thirdly, I think because we know big companies, that really helps them. So, you know, if you look at, we founded a biodiversity company who probably has sold the first major BNG unit. And there's lots of good things about that company, but it wasn't a coincidence that the first person they sold it to was a house builder that we know very well. And then Raspberry Pi is a classic example of, if you are lucky enough to go through all the process, then clearly at the listed level, we can help in any number of different ways. I think what's interesting is how our help might iterate in the next few years. I mean, obviously, the first way is hopefully helping them build a set of investors rather than just us from our co-investment that we talked about. Clearly, as the companies get more mature, they get closer to the area that we understand. So you would think we should be able to give them more help if we are good at the later stage stuff. And then thirdly, definitely the characteristic of what we haven't done as much, but will do more of in the future, is with having 10-ish investments that we're really scaled into, we will be part of, I'm not sure necessarily say we'll be a board member of every single one, but we will want to be intimately involved in them, in the way that I have been with OSE, with Natigal, which any one of my colleagues have been with two or three. And at that level, I think we've got quite a lot of experience that we can pass on.
We talked earlier on about, reflected on the interview we recently conducted with Neil Woodford, and some would say, well, he was drawn into this area, it's laden with problems. And how might you say your approach differs?
Recognizing the same prize is not the same as taking the same process to get there. And I think going back to my OSE point, I think I would apply the same logic there, namely that it's obvious the UK's got a ton of IP. If it's difficult to do, you've got to be really focused on what the right way to do it is. This is why now is so exciting, in that, but equally dictates this, which is, I think now really for the first time, we've got that synergy of people wanting to invest, companies ready for the investment. It should work now. But the only way it's going to work is if it's done in a really disciplined fashion. And so for me, in a way, the dominant thread for me is be incredibly disciplined and price sensitive about this. You know, the commercial thing, I think the biggest danger in all of this is that the passion overtakes. You're only going to achieve the passionate outcome if you get the commercials right. And one of the challenges of UK thing is actually the returns haven't been that great, despite the lack of capital.
Right.
And so I think hopefully the thing that has always been, it's particularly clear to me now because I think we got the chance to do it right. I think it's always hopefully been a bit clear to me that if you don't do things commercially, it doesn't matter what your passion is, you're not going to achieve it. But the need for us to only, and actually interestingly within OSE, for instance, we were often approached to make building donations or stuff like that. And the guy who ran it, Dave Norwood, was always crystal clear on that point, which says if we don't do this hyper commercially, the opportunity is going to disappear from us. And so I think the aim off, if you like, for me in this process, in the same, if you think about back to what I said about listed investing, about, you know, I was good at analysis, had to learn trading. I think the aim off here is, I know that you've got to be almost more commercial. And the way to achieve these civic outcomes is by making this the best investment people have ever seen. And that's a duty that we have. I mean, we have it anyway to our clients, but I think that duty is particular in this instance. And so I think that's my overriding principle. For me, the commerciality dominates the passion.
And that's clear and has been lost by all sorts of entities. Now, I was reading one of your recent reports in which you write, technology has never been so broadly disruptive and commercial. Yeah. Just unpick that a little bit.
Oh, gosh, that sounds like one of those dangerous phrases that when you actually try and examine it, it doesn't mean very much. I mean, it's interesting for what we're doing. I mean, it's definitely the case that, you know, uniquely in the last decade, you've had scale of technology that's, and now if you look at things like the speed of technology progress, you know, you can probably argue things like that. I think for what we're doing, though, oddly enough, for what we're doing, I think we're scaling out stuff that's pretty well proven. I mean, one of the weird things for me is I look at the kind of opportunities we're going to take. And yes, disruptive isn't quite the right word because they're enabling, I would say, most of the time. But the reality is that because the scale-up capital is, one of the interesting things today is the scale-up capital is taking so much longer than it should have done, that probably one's got 3 years more proof points than one normally would have when one was putting in this. And actually, it's kind of, you know, so we have companies that we'll invest in which are kind of profitable, nearly profitable, and you know, doing tens of millions of revenue. If one thinks of scale-up capital, they need the scale-up capital to really fulfill their potential. But I think you just do, and actually going to the mistakes we made, one of the other mistakes we made, which I don't think it was a mistake, but is lost us money, is if you take something like Quantum, for instance, fairly deliberately, we invested in two or three opportunities at the beginning with our money because we just didn't really know and we wanted to learn a bit. You know, what we've learned over the last 5 years is one of the three companies has done phenomenally well. And we know it inside out and we can see how much better it's done. And sure enough, in this fund, we would want to back it aggressively. It's kind of interesting in a way is that the scale-up opportunity, actually going back to the cost of capital point, you have a surprising amount of evidence that we've accumulated over the years that we should be processing really effectively in the next few years if we get it right.
So when you think about this, and I'm not holding to you the 10 companies in the portfolio, but we're all sort of classically brought up around levels of diversification and thinking about prioritization. How do you think about the sector overlaps or the, you know, you referred to a number of industries that are exciting you. How do you just juggle that, you know, that challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think in practice, unlikely to be more than two in any industry, as has happened a bit with sport in the last fund, conceivable that something like defense, for instance, Helsing may just dominate everything and it would be crazy to do anything new. But hopefully, if there were something to do, we would probably do it. And we've got three or four interesting things that we're thinking about doing. You know, and if the world really takes off towards the end of the period, we may get crowded out of rounds because capital's freely available at the end of it. So I don't think it should be a big problem. I think finding three or four a year, given where we're starting from, of things we feel incredibly strongly about, feels about the right balance between some diversification. I mean, you know, if we did everything we saw, it wouldn't be probably a very good, it wouldn't fulfill my criteria of commerciality.
Of, you've hinted a couple of times about this disintermediation or change in sport. So I know you're a great student of sport in all sorts of areas. Realistically, there's a lot of capital that's poured into all sorts of things, you know, particularly at the brand ed level. Is it practical to think that there's serious investment opportunities in the UK?
Well,
or if not in the UK, that will be accessible.
It will be, it's definitely practical because I could think of, you know, we nearly did the 100 but didn't because other people, to your point, we did get crowded out there. One thing I should say is we'll also do about three or four late stage opportunities and three or four really early stage opportunities where the aim is to create a couple of the late stage opportunities later on in the fund. And definitely, I think the most plausible candidate I can think of that I've seen in the last 3 months for one of those early stage opportunities is a sport-oriented technology company. You know, the data creation within sport is something we've worked really hard on and not quite found the right vehicle so far. But I think all of these sports are going to get transformed by data. And if you think about the sports where the UK is kind of credible, other than football, things like golf, cricket and horse racing are all incredibly data oriented. And the value of data, that dual value of data, both from the professionalization of the sports, but also enhancing the experience of watching or participate. You know, essentially, data does two things. It makes the performance of the sport better and as there's more money in the sport, that, you know, Formula One being the best example. And clearly the other thing they can do, you, often through gambling, is make the experience of sport more vivid to the viewer and thereby enhance the value of it. I think probably more likely for us is that one of our early stage investments would be in that kind of area than, like you say, I can't immediately see the late stage investment in the way, but who knows?
And for anybody who's interested on that sport and finance, we had Ian Charles from Arctos talk about how they've deployed, I think it's nearly $10 billion in particularly the, you know, the US closed leagues, but it is fascinating. Now, if I understand it correctly, I was talking to one of your colleagues and you've hinted at it, but the co-investment becomes quite important as you go along. So maybe just talk a little bit about what type of investors make most sense for what you're doing.
Well, I think, I hope anyway, certainly for us and for a bunch of individuals, the simple prospect of a fund done in these areas with the discipline we described, you know, the basic, coming back to my commerciality point, making the returns on this fund super attractive, such that people want to invest in this kind of thing again, hopefully with us, is the basis of everything. So, you know, we will, including ourselves, have people who just say, look, all I want to do is get Pete to do some of this stuff for me, and I'll probably have four or five other people I do. I think when we think about the big investors who we're talking about, who in 5 years' time in some form, and some of them have, you know, someone like M&G, for instance, have been doing it for a while, others, different levels, what you're faced with is people. One of the reasons Mansion House probably hasn't come as quickly, I think, is that it wasn't immediately obvious how the private sector developed the capacity to make these investments confidently was hard for people. You know, one thing we know is these things haven't been done very much. So the idea that you want to put a ton of money into something, quite rightly, many of these big companies were going, how do we do that? Don't quite know how. And then secondly, and I think fairly actually, the fee structure of the traditional venture community was somewhat higher than the general fee structure of that these schemes are exposed to. And, you know, there is some debate around about, was that a regulatory error that should the regulators have encouraged higher fees? And perhaps at the early stage venture, that is true. I think actually the problem of fees at the scaling up level is much more that if people were running 50 billion, then the fee level percentage-wise could be much lower because the businesses would thrive. You know, it's quite hard. On the one hand, you've got the sort of chicken and egg thing. Unless the fees get down to that level, the people won't invest that quantum of money. And yet, unless the quantum of money is there, many firms find it difficult to offer that fee space. And so I think what we've done is try and solve for both of those problems by saying what we want is, we need a fund to lead these things, but we want co-investors. We want to help people like that get into this area in a way that gives them optionality and value for money through using co-investment. Some will, I'm sure, get us to do the co-investment initially, partially for them. Others will do it themselves, depending on their thing. But the basic premise is that if you imagine the first 10 or 15 million of any investment goes into the fund, the next bit will go in co-investment, much cheaper, obviously, both for us to produce and for them. We pass that benefit on. So somebody who does, I don't know, have 25% in the fund, 75% in co-investment, their blended fee rate comes down to something that looks very compelling in my view. And through doing that, they get two other benefits. One is if they want to, they can exercise some degree of selectivity. So for instance, we have some clients who don't particularly want to do critical minerals. It's outside traditional venture. And yet, you know, from my perspective, it's got very similar returns, etc. But some people don't want to do that. That's fine. Other people really want to amplify something like the biodiversity we do. And so I think what we'll end up doing through that co-investment thing is also giving our investors a chance to sort of specialize a bit gradually, I suspect, take more of the decision in-house versus what we're doing for them. And for our companies, actually, if they get a client base, which is, I don't know, 15% of around as us, 30% is co-investment from half our clients who really like that company, and that gives them a chance then to feel confident when they go out to other investors, knowing, you know, I think that creates a good capital base for that company, especially given that most of our investors probably want to be investing way more in the future than they are going to ever do with us. You know, they're going to do multiples of what they do with us. So I think it should work quite well, but we'll see.
This is also for listeners who are trying to understand whether it's right for them serving as a due diligence process. So let's just make sure I've got some of my facts right. Target size is somewhere between sterling 150 to 200 million.
Yeah, I think we want to do 10. And going back, start from the premise of we reckon we can find 10 decent scale-up rounds of about 100 million where we'd want to be 10 to 15 million. They should be the bulk of the capital in the fund. On top of that, we want to find through, you know, you always have to account for, we want to do another 10 early stage ones, which will be 1 to 2 million each to help us create the scale ups in the future. and make good returns. And clearly you always want to keep a bit back in a fund for, you know, stuff happens. And so, yeah, 150, 200 would be our aspiration.
Sterling denominated, 10-year life.
Yeah, very standard. And to be finally decided exactly all of the tweaks as we go through with some of our larger investors, exactly what they want. But I mean, what's different? In a way, we had the hedge fund where we did in a very small way, had a lot of flexibility. We then spent 5 years running a fund, which was us plus family, to give ourselves the right to do something that is very much a client-oriented business. This is a very standard fund. It's been created in a very non-standard way, which I think is hugely interesting and means that we, I think, can do something really differentiated. But the whole point of this is to make a standard fund at the beginning of what I hope is the asset class becoming a big part of many investors who haven't hitherto participated in it. That capital, in turn, A, helping generate enormous returns for the people who are early in it, as it normally does, as I think we are, and B, having really positive consequences for society as a whole, and both through the disruption and enabling impact these companies have, but also for the economic impact that doing this properly will have. So yeah, no, I hope it should be really fun.
Certainly in speaking to you ahead of this, I've got this distinct sense of your considerable enthusiasm for the opportunity. And it's sort of, when you juxtapose it against the backdrop of global uncertainty, I guess, is that, do you think that one of your great strengths is looking through sort of the daily noise in all of your investing sort of activities?
Honestly, I think in this case, our biggest strength is going to be doing it really disciplined fashion and saying, weirdly, there's a tremendous tendency to, contrarianism is very seductive. I think our strength is less that we're overly alert to the long-term prize and more that we're somewhat more disciplined in how we access it. And I certainly think in this case, the prize is not UK IP is underdeveloped. That's a brilliant idea. It's, are you doing it at a timeline and with a discipline that allows you to generate the returns it should generate as opposed to the returns it often has generated? And so I would say actually, whenever you write a review at the end of the year, it's always really simple. We were talking earlier about sort of reviewing stuff. Yes, it's lovely to sort of feel like one's got a very clear analytic framework that justifies doing something. But executing ideas only gets done through really hard work and by not getting carried away by the idea. You know, contrarianism is both the most attractive, often the most dangerous aspect of fund management, I think.
I can testify to that. Before I conclude, Peter, anything we haven't covered that you wanted to cover about the fund?
Hopefully, as a prelude to many people who might come to our Investor Day, what they'll see at our Investor Day on May the 15th, what I've tried to do at the Investor Day is flesh out the individual opportunities, be they thematic or corporate. And if there were one message, I'd love to have them in mind as they do see that, or two, actually. One is, I think we've chosen the right themes and we really differentiate ourselves for the fact we chose those themes many years ago and have worked on them and have narrowed down how we apply that through the last 5 years to something that really is quite compelling today. But secondly, I'm really keen to focus on the discipline with which the companies that we're going to invest in are going to execute the ideas and the precision of the value proposition of it. And I hope if there's one message to come across there, it's the prize has always been huge. We're going to be super disciplined about how we do it. Our dominant thing is getting a really differentiated risk reward for our clients. And we think we can do something amazing in this fund on that basis. But it is both a reward, but also a risk management process that I think is going to be differentiated.
So, Peter, it's been really, really helpful for me to listen to you today talk about your approach. I know you've got this upcoming event, Investor Day, on May the 15th, where you're actually going to showcase some of these individual examples and talk in more detail, which should be very insightful for people who are looking and thinking about if this makes sense in their portfolio. I mean, I've got probably three takeaways is that whilst you are obviously at the primary level a provider of capital to some of these enterprises, what you are able to do is much more than that on their journey, not just for further financings, but from the whole ecosystem and industry knowledge that you developed over the last 30 years. And I think that any company who is thinking about partnering would find that very valuable.
And putting that into financial, I think what we're often okay at is, even with our list of companies, is saying financially that means X, which is often what companies find hardest. You know, that having an investment value proposition that is consistent with the corporate's value proposition is often what they find hardest to articulate.
Secondly, I've written down because you've said it twice, and it's not always something that people spend enough time on, is that they think about the prize and therein they get lost in the absence of process, because we can be seduced very easily about sort of, you know, great goals in all sorts of domains. So it's very clear to me that the small number of names that you're going to have, the relative small size of the fund, will allow you to exercise that process, at least potentially, in a way that some more diversified funds can't, and that you are seeing in all sorts of domains, and you've mentioned, you know, from healthcare technology, defense, sport, there are, you know, there are reasons to be pretty optimistic that, you know, IP in the UK is there offering some terrific potentials. But you have, to a certain extent, the advantage of having, you know, seen it already for a while.
Yeah, and also coming back to prudence about this, and perhaps you made some comparisons earlier, the capital is coming now, and that's why we're doing a fund. It is actually, I think, a pretty good, you know, timing is the other aspect about fund management that makes ideas often not quite manifest themselves as clearly. I feel very strongly that because we've allowed the opportunity to iterate without forcing the opportunity to go quicker, and it's very clear now that the opportunity is, okay, how do we bring in this capital that wants to go there? That, to me, is exactly when you should expect to make very good returns out of it. I think forcing the opportunity to come quicker than it might naturally come, you know, is related to the point about the prize, and often related to perhaps about confidence levels. And I think what's so exciting today is the very fact that we think we can do this kind of fund. In a way, what we've done is say, look, the time when you should do it is when people want to do it and be one of the first couple to do it, which is what we did in hedge funds, if you think about it, is we were one of the first people to come and sort of institutionalize the hedge fund world. And the fact we did it at that point probably helped enormously the returns, because it was just, you're anticipating doing it early but not too early is usually the right thing in fund management. And I think what's so compelling today is that we feel anyway that we can raise this kind of fund with this kind of co-investment opportunity today gives the investment within the fund so much a better chance of being a success than had we forced ourselves to do it at a point where it wasn't easy to do.
Great. You've helped me with my conclusion, so I think we may say thank you very much, Peter,
pleasure,
for being
thank
here
you.
Today.
Enjoyed it a lot.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.